Well, beloved, you might be wondering, because you say to yourself, we had a message on Nehemiah 13, that's the last chapter of the book, right? Thought we were done with this series, Nehemiah, Arise and Build. And as is so often the case, it's helpful. We did this with the life of Saul, and I was burdened about it and was thinking, well, is there something that we need to do now that we've looked at the final chapter and the final message? Is there something more that we need to do just to impress this on people's minds? Is there sort of a summarizing message with the things that we've seen so far? And I'll be totally truthful for you. I just couldn't get away from this. In the Sunday school class this morning, Jack was talking about the fact that the message or lesson that he had was one that was deeply on his heart. And I just couldn't get away from this. And so this morning, I want to bring you a message that I've entitled Nehemiah, Remembered or Forgotten. I want us to ponder, as we say goodbye to the series at least, on Nehemiah, the burden that seems to be preeminent on his heart as he closes the book. And so in the reading, you notice I asked Brother Don to single out those things because three times he has prayers that involve asking God to remember him. So you notice in verse 14, once again, remember me, O my God. Then you drop down to verse 22, and you have to go a little ways in it, but remember me, O my God. And then you look at verse 31, and remember me, O my God, occurs once again. I think that's an amazing thing. I think that's something we need to call out. I think that's something we need to talk about, because it provides us, I think, a very useful insight into the heart of this man of God. Because see, folks, what's going on here is not a man who's concerned about his legacy with people. Not someone who's fixated on that in a selfish way. You know, sometimes we hear about that. Sometimes politicians get into their last term and they're worried about how they're going to be remembered. They're worried about their legacy. And so I think sometimes it influences what they do and decisions they make when maybe it's not totally objective. They're just concerned for themselves in some way. How will they be remembered? But you notice that's not Nehemiah's prayer at all. He doesn't ask for people to remember him. He asks God to remember him. And there's a big, big difference. As I said to you, I think Nehemiah, it provides us an insight into the heart of this man of God. And I've mentioned this on other occasions that through this man whom we have kind of labeled a quintessential leader, there are so many opportunities in the book where it's almost like he gives pause. He gives the opportunity, of course, led by the Spirit of God, for us to gain a glimpse of what it's really like to serve God as he did and to be a leader and what were his burdens and what did he struggle with. So question this morning, do you think that people who serve God, especially people who serve God publicly, people that you see all the time, you think they struggle with things too? Or you just sort of think that, well, they're a special class and God has just sort of called them and he's given them special grace and they never face any temptations, they never face any days of discouragement. You think that? Folks, the fact of the matter is, from the one up on the platform to the last person on the back row, we're all cut out of the same bolt of cloth. We all have a fallen and sinful nature that we inherit from Adam. And in due course, as soon as we're able to understand and make choices of our own, that nature manifests itself when we do things that are wrong. And we have the inherent weaknesses of the flesh. The psalmist talks about God remembering his frame, that it's dust. And there are times, I'm sure, that pride sweeps us away, but in more sobering moments, we recognize that, oh no, 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 we're just the same as everyone else. We face our own set of trials. They may be different, but we face our own set of trials. Everyone does. Everyone comes here this morning with problems. How many unspoken requests did we have this morning in the Sunday school class that meets here in the auditorium? Everybody brings things, and it's why I so often pray, dear God, help us to be able to be uplifted. Help us not to be concentrating so much on our own situations and our own problems that we totally miss the things that God brought us here that might elevate us and help us to change focus, which is really the key to the whole thing, and it's hard to do sometimes. Well, I think Nehemiah is struggling here with a question. I think it's an insight into his personal life. I think it's a question we all have. If you think about it looking back, if you think about this being the end of the book, and you think about Nehemiah looking back, now he's been here for at least 12 years, right? He comes to Jerusalem. We find that out in chapter 1. But when we get to chapter 13, we find that 12 years he was there. Then he went back to Artaxerxes, the king of Persia, Babylon, and he was able to return again. But see, it's not like Nehemiah just went there on some kind of a short-term mission trip. And that's one thing. It's not like Nehemiah did that. No, he was there, and now the book is looking back, and he's thinking about this question. To live as I have lived, to expose myself to the things that I've been exposed to sacrifice as I have, is it really worth it? Is it really? And I will just point out to you that I think you're now dealing with a question not only that people face day to day. Sometimes I think it's just unspoken. Is it really worth it trying to live for Jesus? But I think really you get to the end of life, and I think it's sometimes a struggle you have. Looking back, wondering about the choices you've made, wondering about the fact that you chose to turn this way in life and dedicate yourself to live and work for God, whether that's in a full-time capacity or not, and wondering, did I do the right thing? Did it really prove out? Was it really worth it? This is why I chose that chorus that we sang a while ago. So be steadfast, unmovable, always abounding in the work of the Lord. For as much as ye know, yeah, we know up here what is in here when we face those struggles and those questions. For as much as you know that your labor is not in vain in the Lord. And folks, I want to point out something to you. This is where the encouragement in this lies today. God answered his prayer, and I'm going to use a Vogue expression, in an Uber way. You notice everything's Uber now? So I thought I'd throw that out just to wake young people up. Ephesians chapter 3 and verse 20 says, now unto him that is able to do Uber. He's able to do exceeding abundantly above all that ye ask or think according to the power that worketh in us. Do you believe that? All right, we need to believe that, and we need to be encouraged by that. God is not unfaithful to forget your work and labor of love that ye have shown toward his name, and that ye minister to the saints, labor for the saints, and do minister. No, God doesn't forget those things. How did God answer his prayer in an Uber way? There's a whole book here, right? Nobody's going to forget Nehemiah, not that reads the Bible. God decided, you know what? This man whom I called, this man who proved himself by my grace to be this quintessential leader, this man who served me in so unique a way and whom I use so greatly, I'll hear his prayer. What's there is important enough for me to record in the Bible in a book that we now call by his name. No, we're not going to forget Nehemiah. God answered his prayer. Sad truth is, people do forget. We do all the time. We take for granted all the time the people around us and the things that we have. All the time we do it. All of us do it. How little we recognize what we have should it be taken away from us. God doesn't forget, even if people do. So, quickly as I can this morning, I prayed about four things that I think it's really important to take away from the life of Nehemiah that God wants us to remember about this man. Because God said, I'm not going to forget, I heard your prayer. So what are they? First of all, prayer. Nobody wants to hear you talk about prayer. It was in my first message when I, before we even looked at chapter 1, I talked about Nehemiah, the quintessential leader. But nobody wants to really talk about that because prayer is hard work and most people are convicted the moment you bring the subject of prayer up because people don't pray much. Just like truth of the matter be known, people don't spend much time with God's word. You say, Pastor, you're talking to the church. People came, took trouble and time to come to church on a Sunday morning. I know, I'm not being unkind. I hope you know that. I'm just telling the truth. And I think you know I'm telling the truth. I think we all struggle. I don't necessarily find it any easier in some ways to pray than I used to. In some ways, I find it more difficult. I find new challenges in my prayer life as I get older. Harder to concentrate, believe it or not. All kinds of things that you struggle with. Easier, at least for me, to be distracted. But prayer, and I think we saw this, prayer permeated everything that Nehemiah did. It was the absolute, his piety is what I called it in that opening message. It was the absolute foundation of everything he did. Before anything else, his life with God, what we would call our devotional life, made him successful. That's a really interesting thing when you realize that it's not much, we don't pay much attention to it. You know what you're doing, and I'm just telling you this too, you are overlooking the absolute key to spiritual success. You will never go and you will never grow for God. And how much you do will be proportional to how seriously you take spending time with God. I'm not saying you have to spend inordinate, at least in terms of how you might think, time, segments of time. I'm saying, is it there and is it a priority? I have a couple thoughts for you about prayer. It might be interesting to notice this, and if you find it helpful, you can write it down. But you will find three types of praying. Prayer is all through the book. You can't escape it. Anybody that reads the book, you can't escape prayer. You just can't get away from it. And so turn with me back to chapter 1 for a moment. We won't take time to look at all the examples. There just isn't. Because all of my points, all four of these things are set up this way where I'll allude at least to things in the book to show you that this is true of Nehemiah. But in chapter 1, the book starts, and it begins with formal prayer. So think about that for a moment. Is there a place in our life for formal prayer? It begins in chapter 1, verse 4, where we read that he heard as he was back the king's cupbearer. He was still in the court of Artaxerxes at this point when his brother and others brought back news of the terrible conditions at Jerusalem. And it says, it came to pass when I heard these words that I sat down and wept and mourned certain days and fasted and prayed before the God of heaven. And then it goes on to give that prayer, and that prayer goes through the whole end of the chapter. And we look at this in kind of a more formal context. There were times of formal prayer in his life, but there were also times of what I like to call flair prayer. Formal prayer is when you have a dedicated moment. It might be public in church when we have a morning prayer in our worship service, or it might be that scheduled time that you have. But what about when you don't have a scheduled time, but you have a real situation come up? Flare prayer is what, it's not original with me, but I like to call it that. And you find it scattered throughout the book all the time. Look at chapter 2, verse 4. You're there, so it's right across the page. Then the king said unto me, for what dost thou make thy request? And all this little phrase just tucked away, but you find it several times like this in the book. So I prayed to the God of heaven. Well, and think about this for a minute, folks. He's in the presence of the king. It's not like you can say, excuse me, could I have a time out? Could I go into the next room? I need to pray. It's not like that. And many occasions in life are like that when all of a sudden we face a challenge and we can't just have a formal time of prayer. But all through the book, you have these occasions where this is true. And you have it in chapter 4 and verse 4. Just look at one more. I want to just be sure that we get the flavor of this, but I think you recall it from the book. It says here he's facing these opponents. He's facing persecution. He's facing opposition. And he just says, hear, O our God, for we are despised. Turn their reproach upon their own head and give them for a prey in the land of captivity. All the time he did this, just short, quick prayers. I think it's really the essence of what Paul was talking about when he said, pray without ceasing. That you're always in an attitude or in a position in your relationship with God that you can call on him even if you say no words, even if your lip doesn't move. But you can pray and you can send a flare prayer right from your heart to the throne of God above. That is a blessing to be able to do that. And then there's a third kind of prayer, and I'm going to call it devotional prayer. These are prayers that I think give unique insights into the heart and life of Nehemiah as a servant of God and as a leader. I'm going to give you an example. Turn a page or so to chapter 5, verse 19. There's a real insight that this provides, but we don't have time. I just want you to see it. Here in this chapter, he's dealing with these greedy nobles who see the conditions of need around them, people struggling, not having enough food, yet they're trying to dedicate themselves to the work of building the wall. And here you have these greedy people that are still exacting from them usury, that is interest and all this kind of thing. And Nehemiah stands up to those people and he makes a stand on that. And then you get to the end and it talks about some of that. And it says, now that which was prepared for me daily was one ox and six choice sheep. And he goes through and he talks about the way he could have lived if he wanted to indulge in all of the allowances that were available to him as the governor. And then he just says this prayer, think upon me, O my God, for good, according to all that I have done for this people. See, he realizes what he's doing. He realizes the commitment that he's made. He realizes the cost to himself personally for the commitment that he's made. And he prays to God and says, think upon me, O my God. These devotional prayers are the same thing that we read for our text. Remember me three times. It's the same thing. It provides an insight into the heart and life of Nehemiah. Beloved, how important it is for us to pray. Prayer changes your focus. Prayer takes your mind off yourself. Prayer helps you look into the face of God, as we heard about earlier. There's a really interesting story that occurred a number of years ago now, about 20 actually. And I think maybe some of the stories and devotionals were on a little higher level back then. But in the Daily Bread of 1995, in fact, the January issue, Haddon Robinson. And Haddon Robinson, if you know that name at all, he would be a writer that you would immediately say, I'm going to get something that's not fluff. I'm going to get something. He told this story. The story concerned a 19th century Southern theologian. But this wasn't really rare to find this to be the case, where, especially in the war between the states, you would have a man who was serving, a Southern officer who was serving, but he might also be in other capacities. And it was true of Robert Louis Dabney. Some people would be familiar with his name. He was a well-known theologian, later helped to start a seminary. But interestingly, he was Stonewall Jackson's chief of staff and also the chaplain. And you can read a book that he's written about that that's very interesting. But talking about leaders and servants of God having their own struggles as he aged, he began to struggle about his impending death. Wow, really? A preacher, a chaplain, would maybe have a tussle with that? He did. We know it because in a letter to a former student and close friend, he revealed it and talked to him in the letter about it. He wondered about his ability to die honorably and to hold fast and firm to his Christian faith. He confided this to his friend. His friend wrote back to him and said this. This is the friend writing back to Dabney. Dear friend, let me advise you as you have often advised me. If you were about to cross a deep chasm and there was a bridge over it, so think about a bridge over a deep chasm, would you stand there looking in at yourself, inward focus? Would you stand there looking in at yourself, wondering if you trusted enough in bridges to be able to cross? That is, you're standing there holding your own hand, worried about whether or not you have the faith to do this because you're looking in. He says, or would you not rather go and examine the beams and timbers of the bridge and the quality of its construction and determine whether the bridge were trustworthy and then pass over it in confidence? Which would you do? Which should you do? And then he makes the application. Our faith is in Christ. Spend yourself focusing on him and his sufficiency rather than yourself. You see, it's exactly the thing that's involved in Psalm 61, verse 2. And I referred to this recently in a message. That verse really reaches out. Every time I read that, I think of that often, even when I'm not reading it. The psalmist cries out, from the end of the earth will I cry unto thee. When my heart is overwhelmed, lead me to the rock that is higher than I. What happens when you realize that you are inadequate, that you cannot do it, that you do not have the strength in and of yourself, and somehow God has confronted you with the absolute reality of that? What do you do then? And you can keep looking at yourself and, and understanding and feeling perhaps to an incredible degree your own inadequacy and your own weakness. Or you can somehow struggle, ask God to give you the grace to change your focus, not be looking at whether you have the faith to cross the bridge, but whether the bridge has the strength to hold you. So whether it's the higher rock or the stronger bridge, which one are we going to look at? Lead me, he says, to the rock. It's a struggle. I don't have it all figured out, I'll tell you that. And I don't have complete victory if it makes anybody feel better. Second thing we need to look at this morning is his courage. I'm amazed at the courage of this man. He did some things that are not within the average person. But see, the whole point that I started out with is the key to that too. There was a foundation upon which he was drawing. It wasn't Nehemiah. He had his inadequacies. Nehemiah was no different than me, no different than you. He struggled. That's what we're seeing. He had this question, is it really worth it, what I've done? But somehow, he rose to the occasion. He rose to so many occasions that most people would totally compromise and cop out. That most people don't have, excuse me for being frank, the guts. How did he do that? Sometimes I look at the thing and I say, how did he do that? Well, there's a lesson there. But all the way back in chapter 2, one of the first examples, if you're close to that, just turn back for a moment. I want to at least give us a couple things so that you see what I'm talking about. He had the courage to approach the king. You see, in the end of chapter 1, verse 11, it says, for I was the king's cupbearer. Then he tells us, I'd never been sad in his presence before. You weren't supposed to do that. And he, all of a sudden, when he realized that this burden, this, as he reveals in prayer in chapter 1, for Jerusalem, and the fact that God was burdening him to go and do something and be involved and not just pray for others to go and do something and be involved. And he knew eventually he would have to talk to the king about it. And finally, 4 months later, this is what we have here. The opportunity presented itself. And the king, we were talking about in Sunday school this morning, being able to read faces. What do they say? King looked at him and knew he was troubled. And when the king did that, Nehemiah said, uh-oh, I'm in it now. That's why it says, so I prayed in the end of chapter 2, verse 4, to the God of heaven. And then somehow those fears were calmed. Try to remember that this man earlier, as it's recorded in the book of Ezra, had given a decree that the work at Jerusalem should cease. This is no small thing. Nehemiah's antsy about this for a good reason, because he's got to seek permission. He's got to present this thing that God has put on his heart to a man who already has a mindset in a different direction and who's actually already made a decree in a different direction. But he does it. How did he get that courage? And we see it so often in the book. Look at chapter 4, verse 6. We'll just look, like I said, there. I have so many examples, but there's not time. I just want you to get your feet wet with this. When these people, chapter 4 is the most in-depth chapter we have in the book of the opposition that he faced. And these people, this is real, folks. This is real stuff. This wasn't just somebody sending him an unkind letter. These are people who are armed and who are devious and deceitful, who have no ethics, who would do anything to stop the work at Jerusalem and anything to sandbag what Nehemiah was doing. And so we have the record of that here, but we also have the record of how Nehemiah responded to it. So if you look at verse 6 for a moment, so we built the wall, and all the wall was joined together under the half thereof, for the people had a mind to work. He just kept right on going. Later in the chapter, verse number 9, nevertheless, we made our prayer unto God, yet and set a watch against them day and night because of them. See, he understood that there was a balance between praying and practical actions, and he wasn't afraid. He set a watch. And then we get deeper into the chapter and read something else. Verse number 13, therefore set I in the lower places behind the wall and on the higher places. I even set the people after their families with swords and spears and their bows. This guy had courage. I'm just telling you, where did he get it from? He had to deal with persecution without. He had to deal with problems within. Chapter 5 is the record of being opposed by the nobles and their selfishness, as I already mentioned. And he said to them, I mean, he went directly to them, confronted them. Chapter 5, verse 10, I likewise and my brethren and my servants might exact of them money and corn. I pray you, let us leave off this usury or this extracting of interest. And he was willing. He was willing to face problems from without. He was willing to deal with problems from within. And then I think as the book concludes, you find the most incredible. I think this takes more strength and more courage than anything else you do. He that hath ears to hear. What is chapter 13 the record of? Well, we looked at three verses. Now let's quickly look at three others. Look at verse 11. Because you're going to see something in each of these that matches. Just like you saw, remember, now you're going to see another word. Verse 11, then contended I with the rulers and said, why is the house of God forsaken? And I gathered them together and set them in their place. Verse 17, then I contended with the nobles, first the rulers, now the nobles of Judah, and said unto them, what evil thing is this that ye do and profane the Sabbath day? And verse 25, and I contended with them and cursed them. That's not using bad language. And smote certain of them and plucked off their hair. I always laugh when I read that verse. And made them swear by God, saying, ye shall not give your daughters unto their sons, nor take their daughters unto your sons or for yourselves. What is this? What is this third thing? It's one thing to stand up to persecution from without. It's another thing, perhaps a little harder, to deal with problems within. This is a more in-depth ramification of dealing with problems within. And here is how I would describe this. It's confronting, being willing when necessary to confront sin in the lives of God's people. I just tell you right now, I'd rather talk to a guy outside any day than a guy inside. It's not easy. This is, remember, when he came back after being gone, after he'd been there 12 years, he went to the king, got leave to come back and continue his leadership of the people, and found all these things that he had worked hard to accomplish slipping because of people in positions of leadership that weren't towing the line. So much more I could say here, but sometimes it becomes necessary, right? You believe that? Otherwise, I can't understand. Just hear me a minute. Otherwise, I can't understand why Paul tells Timothy, preach the word. Be instant in season, out of season. Reprove, rebuke, exhort with all longsuffering and doctrine. Who wants to rebuke? Who wants to reprove? Oh, that's lots of fun. That's just thrilling. You live for that every day, right? You're a fool. Much easier to have peace, much easier to ignore things. The trouble is, some things you can't ignore. I'm just saying, he that hath ears to hear. And that verse that I just quoted to you from 2 Timothy 4, along with many, 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 many verses elsewhere in the Bible, document that doing that kind of thing, the reprove and rebuke thing, that is not only well within the authority, but well within the scope of pastoral and church leadership responsibility. To the point that if you refuse to do that and ignore your responsibility in that area, you failed God. I don't get antsy. I don't have anybody in mind. I'm just saying that there come times when that has to be done. And it was true here. These were people in positions of leadership. They were doing things that were wrong. They were doing things that they'd covenanted and committed not to do. I think I told you this story once before, but this is another one that I have to smile every time I read this. Remember when, if you studied history or remember, I can't believe how old these things have gotten now. I don't know what happened. It was just new to me yesterday. But you remember, at least from reading, when Nikita Khrushchev was the premier in Soviet Russia. Soviet Russia. Of course, I'm not sure. They're still not Soviet Russia, but anyway, the USSR, we don't continue to have. The Union of Soviet Socialist Republics, now we have Russia and Putin. So what's changed? Don't see too much that's changed, but anyhow, it's not my message. Anyway, Khrushchev was denouncing the policies and the excesses and some of the horrible things that his predecessor Joseph Stalin had done. That's well known, documented. In a public meeting one day, he was speaking doing this. And there was a man in the audience, talk about having some nerve. There was a man in the audience who said this, "You are one of Stalin's colleagues. Why didn't you stop him?" He said, "Who said that?" Dead silence. Silence you could cut with a knife. He let it hang for just a moment over the audience and then finally said, "Now you know why." It's easy to talk about in theory. Not easy to do, but he found the courage to do it. Remember where he got that. He got that from his life that he based on prayer and time with God, his care. These will be briefer. His care is the third thing I want to mention. When it came to God's work and God's people, Nehemiah was never lackadaisical. Never. He's famous for his plans. Every time you turn a couple chapters, he's got a plan. Because he realized that you have to translate burden into action. But if you just come up with a plan that's half-cocked and you haven't prayed and found God's leadership in the thing, plan's not going to be any good. This is why I say the prayer was the underpinning of everything. Always had a plan. He's famous for his plans. Let's just look at one example. There are about four of these, and we don't have time, but just go back for a moment. If you're in chapter 13, go back to chapter 5 for a moment. So when we have this turning point in the book, and now the wall has been rebuilt, that sort of ends with chapter 6, verse 15. You get into chapter 7. Now his efforts and attentions are refocused on revitalizing, repopulating, and seeing Jerusalem revived. And he has a plan. Chapter 7, verse 5, "Now God put it in mine heart to gather together the nobles, the rulers, the people, and they might be reckoned by genealogy. And I found a register of the genealogy of them which were come up at the first and found written therein." When you read that, you say, why is that important? Well, it's important because he's struggling now with getting the city repopulated and revitalized, and he realizes that he's got to have a strong foundation. He's got to find the people that he could put in positions of leadership to accomplish the spiritual goals that he had. And so he starts with that, determining who met the qualifications, whose names were in the genealogies, because they had this mixed situation going on. And then when you can compare that to chapter 11, verse number 1, then you see here's another plan. That's why you have these lists, because he mentions all the people who became a part. The rulers of Jerusalem, the rulers of the people that dwelt at Jerusalem, the rest of the people also cast lots to bring about 1 in 10 to dwell in Jerusalem, the holy city, and 9 parts to dwell in the other cities. So what are you going to do? Jerusalem is central to the nation's spiritual well-being. But you don't have enough people to keep the city running, especially in the face of all this opposition. So he had a plan. He put that before the people. They cast lots. He had them agree. They cast lots that 1 in 10 would agree not to go back to his hometown, home village, home city, but live in Jerusalem. He always has a plan. I see this stuff, and it amazes me. He was meticulous in his attention to worship. I mentioned that to you before. Derek Kidner is the commentator who has such a helpful phrase when he assesses the point that I'm making now, when he says that for Nehemiah, worship was too important to be left unplanned. And so you have chapter 11 where he organizes all these people, and finally you get to chapter 12 and verse 27. I just want you to see that very quickly. Chapter 12, verse 27, he organizes this dedication. And at the dedication of the wall of Jerusalem, They sought Levites out of all their places to bring them to Jerusalem to keep the dedication with gladness, both with thanksgivings and with singing, with cymbals and psalteries and harps. Remember that? Got the people on the wall, two groups, one started one way, one started the other, and they had this incredible service of dedication that the wall was completed. He never gave God what was left over, and he never gave God his second best. Always gave God the first. If you live your life that way, will you ever get to a place where you ask yourself the question, was that worth it? He did. It's an interesting insight into his heart. Here's the last thing, his humility. I want you just to progress with me so that you can at least see the thought that I have here. You see, when he came to Jerusalem, the very first thing, and I have three little thoughts here to develop this progression for you. At first, we see what we might call a taste of success. Chapter 2, verse 18, "Then I told them of the hand of my God, which was good upon me," that's the people in Jerusalem, "as also the king's words that he had spoken unto me, and they said, let us rise up and build." Remember how he went out by night and looked at the walls and was praying and trying to gather, how am I going to approach these people? These are the people who have been here and let all this go. These are the people who have been here and kind of presided, as it were, over the decline. And they become comfortable with this way of living in this state of affairs, and it's not what God would have. It's a reproach. How am I going to motivate them? And he goes out by night. He looks at everything. He sees the challenges he's up against. And then again, I keep saying this prayer, this life with God was the foundation of everything. When he lays his plan on them, they respond. They say, let us arise and build. It's a wonderful thing when God works it in such a way that your burden becomes the people's burden. That's what you're always striving for, see, when your burden that God has given you becomes the people's burden. Again, I'm cutting this, but he has a taste of success. There are several other examples we could give, but then he has stunning success. Boy, how would you like to be showered with that? You say, I could use a little of that. Well, God knows. God knows what we can handle. God knows what his will is. We just have to trust him. Stunning success. Look at chapter 6, verse 15. "So the wall was accomplished, for the wall was finished in the 25th day of the month Elul in 52 days. A staggering, stunning success. Only God could do that, and God did. And then as time progresses and the years move forward, because this was 52 days into it, we have what you might call continued success. So many examples of this, what we just looked at, how he was able to see God work in the hearts of the people, willing to stay in Jerusalem, a tenth of them. How he was able to organize people for this public reading of God's word. How he was then able to preside over their confession. How he was then able to preside over their recommitment and the signing of the pledge, the covenant that we looked at, their commitment of themselves to the goals that God had given them all. Here's my point, yet he never trumpets it. You never hear him talking about his accomplishments. The only thing you ever really see is his burden that God would think upon him and that God would remember him, that God would conserve what he had done. Not an unreasonable prayer at all. This I've mentioned to you before as well, but it really speaks volumes to me. On Ronald Reagan's desk in the Oval Office when he was president, he had a little sign, something to be reminded of each day. He had a little sign. It said this. Now, I'm going to ask you, how many people operate, whether politicians or preachers, how many people operate with this philosophy? There is no limit to what a man can do or where he can go if he doesn't mind who gets the credit. Wow. That's a struggle, I think, for a lot of us. No wonder God used him so mightily. He prayed, "Remember me, O my God, for good," three times. He is remembered. God has made sure. All of these points about his life, all of these things that he did do. For most of us, God is not going to handle it in quite the same way. In fact, since the canon of Scripture is closed, you don't have to worry about a book of the Scripture enshrining your life and what you did. It just isn't going to be. The truth is there, though, that God, isn't it what he says to us in Hebrews 6:10? Is not unrighteous to forget your work and labor of love, which ye have showed toward his name, in that ye have ministered to the saints and do minister. People, in reality, do and will forget. It's a sad reality. It's one of the things that I try to show you a little different example. I don't always see and hear and remember every little thing, but I shared a praise in the Sunday school this morning. Jack asked for praise items, and I shared a praise about Nora Yingling, the visit that I had with her yesterday up at Huntington Manor, her cheerful countenance. When I said, because there were other people there, when I said to her, I'm sorry to intrude, and to the ladies, I apologized, I don't mean to break up your visit, her response was, no, you can stay longer. Go tell Winnie Oberman that I'm talky today. Don't you love it? Because I told her I had other people there I was going to visit. It was such a pleasure, but you know, I met Nora when I walked through the doors of this church. She was our church secretary, where first she had been recruited by Pastor Palmer to help with the school downstairs when they had the learning center in operation. And then when that came to an end, she went back to work. And then all of a sudden there was a need again at the church, and Pastor Palmer went to her again, and again she responded. I met her when I walked through these doors. She was a kind, helpful, accommodating servant of God. She played the organ and the piano all those years before I came. She did that all those years. Bob Leadham used to say, Nora Yingling plays the happy organ. Kind of helps, doesn't it? She come in here all kind of beat up and run down, and Nora plays the happy organ. She knew how to play for a service at this church. She understood its personality and its people. But she could switch gears. Just when you needed her to, she could switch gears. If I had a funeral service and it was a little different, and I'd say, Nora, can we have something? She'd play the Lord's Prayer and things like that. Why am I taking time to tell you this today? We shouldn't forget. Can she be here? Can you see her? No. But should we forget? No. But this is a sad fact of life that people do forget. And people are often abandoned in rest homes. These are some of the harder visits that most people don't want to make, because they aren't always easy visits, especially when people have mental difficulties and Alzheimer's and things like that. There's a song that we sing. It's not the one that we're going to use in closing, but there's a song that we sing sometimes. It's titled, Have I Done My Best for Jesus? Do you know that it's based on something that happened in the life of a man by the name of Edward Spencer? He was at Northwestern University. This takes us back to the last century, well, actually the 19th century. He was a successful and promising Olympic swimmer, first to ever win a gold medal for the United States, and obviously he had great potential in that capacity for Northwestern to go on. Who knows what he would have accomplished as an Olympic swimmer? Who knows? We'll never know, because one fateful day intervened when he was there in the school in the library studying. When news finally came to them and they got it there, he heard it, that there was a boat offshore in Lake Michigan, see, Northwestern is situated there, that had collided with another boat. It was sinking. People were drowning. He ran from the library to the shores of the lake, saw that the situation was indeed very, very serious, that there were people in peril. The waters were icy. If you've ever been there and seen those Great Lakes, you could hear people just far enough offshore, but you could hear people crying for help, people drowning. Nothing could be done for them. No one really willing under the conditions of the waves and the temperature of the water and everything else. He ran from the library. Without hesitation, he took off his outer clothes that would have simply hindered his swimming. Remember, he was an Olympic swimmer. And he knew that it was his day, that God had prepared him to do this very thing. He dove into the water repeatedly. He made 17 trips and rescued 16 people. And when finally exhausted, he lay there on the shore, people trying to finally prevail on him to stop doing what he was doing before he killed himself. He kept going on and on saying, "Have I done my best, fellows? Have I done my best?" He was in delirium all that night. But he kept saying, "Have I done my best, fellows? Have I done my best?" Well, he had done his best. But see, it cost him his health. He never recovered. That's when the man that wrote this song caught up with him, was interested in his story, a man by the name of Edwin Young. His real name's Ensign Edward Young, but Ensign is not a military rank, it's a name. Found him, caught up with him in Phoenix, Arizona, and a semi-invalid, heard his story, wanted to know more about it. Well, he found a man that was certainly no longer a robust athlete. And during the course of their visit, Young commended Spence for his heroic actions and asked him finally, the people you saved, did anyone ever come back to thank you? His tearful response was this: "No one ever came back even to say thank you." So was it worth it? Was it worth it? Do you think you might sit there as a former and potential gold medalist, Olympic swimmer, but you came to a day and you knew it was your time? Like Esther, come to the kingdom for such a time as this. And you did everything you could do for Jesus. And now you're sitting in some rest home somewhere with lots of time to think, and the old devil pops in there. Think what you could have been. If you hadn't just made that decision and decided to make that sacrifice, think what it could have been. Well, so was he forgotten? Yes, by those people, apparently, that didn't care enough to look him up. But the students at Northwestern didn't. They hung a plaque. It says this: "To commemorate the heroic endeavors of Edward W. Spence, first Northwestern student lifesaver. This tablet is erected by the class of 1898 at the wreck of the Lady Elgin off Winnetka, September 8, 1860. Spencer swam through the heavy surf 16 times, rescuing 17 persons in all. In the delirium of exhaustion which followed, his oft-repeated question was, 'Did I do my best?'" And Young, Ensign Edward Young, wrote the song, "I wonder, have I done my best for Jesus, who died upon the cruel tree? To think of his great sacrifice at Calvary, I know my Lord expects the best from me." Spence gave it. Nehemiah gave it. But don't for one minute think that the struggles are not real. Is it really worth it to live this way and to do these things? And God knows, beloved, that we struggle with that sometimes. So we have Nehemiah, who reveals his heart, who prays three times before the book closes that God wouldn't forget. And God says, no, I won't. How I remember you and how I see fit to do this, we don't quite know how it works out in all of our lives. But we do know that God is not unrighteous to forget your work and labor of love, which ye have showed toward his name, in that ye ministered to the saints and do minister. We need to pray for one another that we'll keep on keeping on.